How about you, King? You want to have a go?
Well, we can talk about Baldur's Gate 3.
Yeah, Baldur's Gate 3 is really good.
XO, have you played
it yet? Which is at my number 3, so there you go.
Have you played it, XO?
No.
No. We gotta fix that.
It's not my kind of game,
honestly. I don't think XO would like it. The only way we could have any semblance of fun is if we played it together.
Yeah. Yeah, multiplayer is really fun. I played with
King. Multiplayer is fun, to be fair.
I know there's like a white-haired elf guy who gets crushed by a building, and then you resurrect him, and then he gets angry at you.
He can be, yes. That is a thing you can do.
I think XO would like Astorian.
He'd probably like a lot of the characters.
Oh, yeah.
Now, do you mean that in XO is a gay person and likes looking at hot men, or do you mean that in I'll think this Astorian guy's funny?
I mean, potentially both.
Well, also the fact that you said that you have a thing for guys with white hair.
Yeah, but he's...
Like, I've literally said that like 20 minutes ago.
I said I like anime boys with white hair.
Oh.
Or silverish hair. Like Robin from Fire Emblem.
No, I think you would like Gale.
I also like Gale. I think he's a cool guy.
But anyways,
Gale just has a nice voice.
He does.
Baldur's Gate game. Let's discuss it.
Well, we are discussing it.
Right now.
Yeah. Gale wants to have sex with me because I let him eat a boot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He wants to eat our shoes. What a guy.
Yeah. He's our MVP.
I do want to say, I do think it's cool that this game won Game of the Year at the Geoff Keighley Awards or whatever.
The Geoff Keighley.
You can tell I've never actually watched one of those Game Awards shows because I don't know how to pronounce his name.
Hey, believe it or not, you're not missing out on much.
It was actually really horrible this year, as opposed to other years where it was absolutely incredible. Yeah, I don't know. Baldur's Gate 3. I struggled to talk about Baldur's Gate 3 because, yeah, I mean, a one game of the year feels like everybody knows why it's good. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, man. If you like, for the same reasons that you would like Dungeons & Dragons, this is pretty much that in a video game form.
Well, I would say if you were ever interested in playing the actual tabletop Dungeons & Dragons and you thought that maybe it's a lot to learn, because admittedly it is, this is the perfect gateway into actually playing the actual game. It does a pretty solid job of teaching you the mechanics. That being said, you really don't get the same kind of experience that you would when you're actually playing Dungeons & Dragons with actual people, you know?
Yeah.
You don't get that. Like, you have an absurd amount of freedom in this game, but, like, you really can't replicate, like, the kind of freedom that you would have while actually playing the tabletop game. Because, like, literally, the limitations are your imagination, you know? Of course, a video game's going to have those limitations and restrictions, but for understanding the rules and the mechanics and how certain characters work, how certain classes or races work, this is a great way to familiarize yourself before even, like, playing D&D.
Yeah, it's the way I describe it is that I think that... So I have Tears of the Kingdom at number 4 and Baldur's Gate 3 above it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because I think they're both very similar kinds of game in that the both of them are really just about freedom of choice at the end of the day. It's just that one of them takes the sandbox buildy approach for puzzle solving. And the other one is more of a, how are you going to solve this encounter? And maybe it will lead to combat. Maybe it won't, depending on how clever you are or what your build is or how you're role playing it.
The choices you make have notable impacts on the story and the world that the game is taking place in.
And I guess that's the thing about it is that, you know, people play stuff like Mass Effect. And I guess when you hear like a choice-based game, people are going to assume it's like, you can be good or you can be bad. And Baldur's Gate 3 is not really like that in the sense that it's not really a binary. It's more like you can approach each situation like 5 different ways depending on who you are, what your class is, or what you're role-playing. And by the end of the game, you're not going to be labeled like completely good or completely bad based on the decisions you make. It's basically, it will add like a footnote to whatever character that you've decided to be. And I think that's the thing about it is that there are so many decisions. Pretty much every session that you play the game, every problem that you encounter, there is more than one way to solve it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the satisfying thing about it is that that's also why for as staggeringly long as Baldur's Gate 3 is, it is rarely ever boring. because no matter what you're doing, there's an interesting decision to be made there. And it makes everything that's happening much more engaging. Even though if you look at Baldur's Gate, it is a fairly typical fantasy adventure story. But again, kind of like D&D, even a fairly typical adventure story is heightened just by the fact that you have so much choice to make it your own thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's probably the best way I can describe it.
Also, the multiplayer is really, really fun.
Yeah,
and
I do like the multiplayer a lot. It's really fun.
King, you just got to say when. I'll boot up the game again, and we'll do it.
I'm always down.
Hell yeah.
It's up to you.
I want Exo to play it with us, though. Like, that would be so much fun.
It would be interesting.
We'd have to start a new game, but I don't know.
We would have to... I would suggest giving Exo a simple class.
Oh, well, the best class best class to start off with is Fighter. It's
because if we don't, it's going to end up like FF14.
Yeah.
Where we're going to be delivering pretzels to people. What a great game.
Because like,
we also got to play 14 again.
If you play like a wizard, it can be kind of daunting.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Whereas if you play like a fighter or something, it's not that complicated, really. So there are some classes that are made for people who are probably more experienced with D&D. And some classes that are obviously there if you don't want to think too much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
By the time you're like level 15 or 16, you're doing like four attacks in one round. I played a fighter. It's really fun. Like in actual tabletop D&D. I loved it. I'm playing a bard in my new campaign.
Yeah, I played a rogue in my main playthrough of 3.
Mm-hmm.
And that went to some places I never expected it would go to. Let me tell you. I made some choices at the end there that I... were kind of wacky,
yeah,
but I love it. Because in any other game, I would not have gone for the crazy shit that I went for, but I just decided to do it because my playthrough was going in a weird direction. I accidentally made some of my party members go evil, and I was like, okay, well, fuck it.
Fuck it, we ball!
Because that's the thing about it, too, is that Baldur's Gate 3 kind of just sweeps you up and you go along for the ride. Like, because you roll dice to make major decisions, and the way I like to play it is if you fail, you just kind of roll with it, at least when I'm on my own.
Within reason.
Sometimes I'll try to do something, and if I fail, I'll be like, whatever, I'm just going to roll with it and see what happens after this.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it leads to you killing people you don't want to kill, but if you let it kind of play out, you might find a more interesting result than you could have expected. So I just think that's awesome.
Within some reason, because I also do think that this game does have a couple of cheap shots where it's like you could not under any circumstance fathom that the game was going to go a certain direction. And then it kind of like gives you a handicap because of that. I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose so.
And the autosave is
the game's
pretty
just very buggy as well.
Yeah.
Sometimes things that you try to do won't go the way that you want them to.
Mm-hmm.
Not because you thought about it wrong, but because it just doesn't work.
Yeah. I've also had like misclicks before where it's like, oh, I wanted to talk to this person, but instead of talking...
Well, I mean, in that case, I will probably reload.
Yeah.
If the game just straight up is like not working. Mm-hmm. I'm like, yeah, well, I'm just going to redo that.
Like, I remember...
Not that... I don't shame people for reloading. It's just the way I play, personally.
Yeah, like within certain reasons, I reload.
You save scummer.
Yeah. Because I don't care how anybody plays the games they play.
Yeah.
But...
Play it how you want.
I guess that's the thing about 3 is that it's the choice game. I think it's even more of a choice game than Zelda was trying to be.
Oh, I thought you meant choices and like, this thing is choice.
Well, it is.
Yeah, and that too.
But you meant like a game where you have a lot of freedom of choice.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at the end of the day, everybody said everything about it that you could possibly say. So that's,
yeah,
the game's awesome.
To me, it's probably going to end up being one of those games that nobody's ever played. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's kind of like how...
Despite it winning Game of the Year.
It's kind of like how nobody has ever seen the Lord of the Rings films.
Yeah.
It's like people talk about them, but nobody's ever actually watched them.
Yeah.
Man.
That's my number 3 of the year.
And I'm sure that a certain someone in the comment section is raging right now, just as he raged when I made my infamous hot take about Uno.
Is that your game of the year, Exo? Is it Uno?
No.
That would be something.
But that is in fact a game I played for the first time this year.
Yeah, do we want to talk about Uno?
We don't talk about Uno. No.
No one's ever played Uno. How can we talk about it?
You son of a bitch, Michael.
I shot that one from the hip. It just came to me.
Damn. I respect it.
All right. Buttface, what's next? What's your next game?
How about I finally talk about Story of Seasons, A Wonderful Life?
Okay. Now, do you have any evidence that this game really exists?
Oh, okay. I could pull out my Switch. Do you want me to get my Switch?
Yeah, I want you to send me a picture of the game cartridge next to your face.
I have it digitally.
Well, you could fake that with Photoshop.
I'm not that good. What if I record a video and I post it on Twitter.com?
You could throw something together in Unity.
I don't have Unity. You're giving me way too much credit. It's a video game. It's a remake. It was really good.
I'm just not convinced that this is, in fact, a real game that exists.
Well, okay. Well, then I'm just going to talk about this game that doesn't exist then. Is that okay?
Sure.
Okay. Well, this game that doesn't...
It'll be a substitute for the fan fiction section we didn't do.
Yeah, this is Ryan's fan fiction right here. Talking about a game that doesn't exist. So, The Story of Seasons, A Wonderful Life is a remake of a game that doesn't exist, and it was really good because it's a farming game, and I like those, and they're really fun.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I played the A Wonderful Life on the GameCube. That was like the first farming sim that I've played, like, ever. And it just had like really, really good atmosphere and it looked really good for the time. And it was just a super relaxing, super peaceful, super quiet kind of game. And for a while, like I always kind of wondered like if they would ever go back to this game or if they would ever make a game like this ever again. And they never really did until they remade it. I'll say that like the pacing is a lot better. So it's like you move a lot faster. Things don't take nearly as long to do. Not much has really changed, like in terms of the core gameplay or in terms of the content. So it's cool to see that the game is still intact. The thing that kind of separates this game from other farming sims, because like in something like Stardew Valley, you get a kid, right? You have bachelors or bachelorettes, and they each have like their own little storyline that you follow. You get married, and then they ask you whether or not you want to have a kid. The kid is never really the focus in these kind of games, but in this game, it actually is. So, like, depending on whether or not your kid is watching you grow crops or if they're watching you take care of your animals, that can actually determine, like, how that kid is going to grow up. Or, you know, if they're watching something on TV or if you show them a specific item. Like, with my kid, for example, I found, like, this golden medal and I was showing it to her. And so now she's training more and more to be an athlete. So I just think that it's a really unique thing that isn't really done, if at all, in any, like, I don't really know a lot of games that, like, are about raising kids. That's not, like, a crappy, like, babies game or whatever, like, for Nintendo DS. So
there was... I showed you a trailer for this earlier last year, but there was some kind of game that was like Tamagotchi crossed with Final Fantasy Adventure or something.
Tamagotchi crossed with Final Fantasy Adventure. I don't remember this.
It's like a Tamagotchi, except instead of a virtual pet, it's like a virtual child that grows up into a hero.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's like an egg or something, right?
Yeah.
And yeah. Then
you can help it battle.
Yeah. Oh, shit. Did you DM that to me?
I did. Yes.
You did. Okay, I need to look that up then. So I think, does that come out this year?
I don't know. I forgot.
Yoke Heroes. It's called Yoke Heroes. A cozy companion RPG meant to be played in a few small 5-minute chunks throughout the day. Yeah.
I thought you were saying Yoke Heroes and like I want.
Yo quiero.
Sí. Yo quiero a mimir. Soy muy cansado.
Yo quiero Taco Bell.
Yo quiero gringos locos.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that, because Yoke Hero is actually my game of the year. Did you know that?
What? Yeah. Fuck! But yeah, I know some people aren't really fond of, like, some of the, I guess, localization changes. And, like, the characters aren't named the same, because I think Natsume still has the right to the original character names, but not the actual characters. The whole Harvest Moon Story of Seasons legal thing, it's a weird and complicated thing. I don't really have the time or energy to explain it.
Mm-hmm.
This remake didn't work for some people, but as far as I'm concerned, I got, like, pretty much exactly what I wanted out of it. I loved it. It made me like really, really fucking happy to play it. And I'm not even kidding when I was saying that if it wasn't for another game that we're going to be talking about, this was going to be my game of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
yeah.
you were being serious.
I was being 100% serious, because it kind of like, I mean, I guess we're here now. I can say that, you know, I'm not really doing YouTube anymore, or, you know, I'm cutting back a little bit. And one of the things that I kind of realized after I stepped away is that a lot of the times I wasn't playing games because I wanted to play them. It was more so like, ooh, I wonder if I could do something with this, you know?
Yes.
So in the back of my head, I wasn't really playing it. I wasn't really enjoying the game for the sake of enjoying it. It was more so like, ooh, I wonder if I can make this into content, you know?
Yeah.
And playing Story of Seasons kind of like reminded me of a time when it's like, nah, you know, you used to play games to escape or to like to calm down or to kill time. And, you know, I don't know. It brought me back there, and it kind of got me a little emotional, and maybe or maybe not. Like maybe that planted the seed of me like realizing that maybe I shouldn't do YouTube as much anymore. Planted the seed because it's a farming game. Ah. But
the spark that will light the fire.
Yeah.
You don't want a fire in Harvest Moon or Story of Seasons.
No.
That's not good.
No. But, you know, I don't know. I got kind of emotional when playing this. And it was like, man, it felt good to be back. So, I loved it. Like, unapologetically, unironically, I loved this game. Eat my butt.
Wow.
Yeah.
If you insist.
Wow. All right, XO, you go.
How many games do you guys have left?
Two.
I also have two, I think.
All right. Then I'm going to guess that this is one all three of us are going to talk about. Anyway, let's talk about my game of the year, Sea of Stars.
That's your game of the year?
Yes, I think so.
That's my game of the year.
Yeah, I fucking said that earlier. You said it was the fucking fake Harvest Moon game.
Well, I had to throw you off. Michael, I
mean, Sea of Stars was almost my game of the year, but it's number two.
Well, where to start with this one? Like, basically, I saw the trailer for it. I'm just like, wow, this looks really, really good. This looks like exactly the kind of RPG that I get into. The kind that I like, one that's more mechanics-based, that has more stuff going on in the overworld. The story's a little simpler. It's got some Paper Mario-esque elements to it, some Golden Sun-esque elements. I'm like, sign me up, please. I'd love to play this. And then I played it, and I was like, yeah, this is pretty much what I got from the trailer, and it's really good. The game's beautiful. It's got, like, this pixel art style, but it's also got, like, real-time lighting in it, too, which is really cool.
Yeah.
Which gives it a certain atmosphere, because, like, it's important to one of the mechanics you get in the game that's honestly kind of underutilized, but still, it's a nice attention to detail. The sprite work is all great and well animated. The soundtrack is fan-fucking-tastic, and I bought it immediately, and I've listened to it.
It has a day and night version like Xenoblade.
Yes, it does, yeah.
It's awesome.
The gameplay is actually pretty solid for a classic-inspired JRPG. Like, it's sort of a blend of Mario and Luigi, Chrono Trigger, and there's a little bit of Golden Sun in there, too, with some of the super moves, like the Zales. What the fuck do you call it when you fill up that rainbow box and then you can do the ultimate move?
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. His super attack is literally the Megiddo from The Lost Age.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's also, like, also the environmental design is very, very Golden Sun.
Yeah. Yes.
Because, like,
I haven't even really played much of Golden Sun, and I recognize that, like, especially when you're in a dungeon.
It's like you're pushing blocks like, around. You play, like, the Bravely Default games, you play something like Final Fantasy VII, and like, let's say you're on like a mountain path or whatever, it's literally just like you go up a mountain, like you walk up a line. But like in The Lost Age, it's like you are like actually climbing the mountains and you're clearing rocks. Yes. And so it makes it feel like as if you're actually scaling a mountain. And not a lot of games do that. Not a lot of games have like a super heavy focus on puzzles. I think Wild Arms does, if I remember right. I played that a while ago, But yeah, to see this game kind of call back to that, it was scratching an itch that I've had for a very, very long time. So I was very happy to see that there.
And like I said earlier, I'm kind of a dummy when it comes to more complicated systems, like especially if they're text-based. Like I remember reading about, what's that system, the style system in Birth by Sleep, where like you add an elemental attribute to your attacks or whatever?
In Birth by Sleep.
Yeah, it's like there are three levels to them, and then you do like a super move at the end. It's like you cast lightning.
Oh, the command styles, yeah.
That's it. Yeah, like it. I had to read through the tutorial for that shit like 4 times before I understood what the hell that is. So I'm kind of slow when it comes to this sort of stuff. And it's part of why I tend to prefer more mechanically oriented games, because I just get it quicker. But what I really liked about this game is basically it revolves around you trying to counter the enemy so that they can't cast big spells and wreck your shit. And you have
It's relatively simple, but not in a way that compromises its potential strategy.
Yeah.
Which is very nice.
So, like, your attacks can either be piercing or blunt damage. There are several elements as well. And basically, the idea is you try to break the enemy's concentration by hitting them with a certain number of melee or elemental type. Like, it'll randomly generate, like, 5 attack types that you have to hit in order to break the spell. And that keeps you actually thinking about what attack you're going to use and what characters you're going to use and where you're going to swap them out and what combination of attacks your characters can do that can counter this enemy spell and keep yourself from being damaged. And that was consistently engaging throughout the whole game. It never got old. And like you said, it's a system that's quick and easy to grasp, even for a dummy like me. But it still adds a lot of strategic value to the fights where you're not just... Because, like, in Xenoblade, I just spam whatever art had just regenerated. I never thought about what art I was using. Because Sharla was just not going to heal me anyway, so it didn't matter.
Rude.
With this, I was actually thinking about what element I was going to use, whether I was going to do blunt or piercing damage and all that good stuff. And I was thinking
about
that
the whole
game.
That's the thing about it, too, is that if you don't abide by this system... It can be pretty difficult sometimes, because if you're not breaking locks, you're going to get hit with some devastating attacks sometimes.
Yeah.
So it feels very satisfying to get those locks broken.
Yeah. The story was pretty decent as well. I do have some issues with the ending, which we can maybe get into in a bit, but...
I have not actually beaten this game, but I'm like right by the end.
Where are you?
Fucking like...
Are you at?
Maybe. It's been a bit. I haven't had a chance to beat it yet, Michael.
If you're that far, then I can probably go ahead and spoil it for you.
Yeah, I don't really care about spoilers. You're good.
Spoilers, people watching the podcast. We are about to spoil this game.
I die at it.
Basically, the story is you're playing as these two Solstice warriors. Their job is basically to destroy these creatures called Dwellers, which if they're left unchecked for too long, grow into World Eaters and will destroy the world. They're created by this big bad guy called the Fleshmancer. You're like a newly trained Solstice warriors, and you only have enough power to fight a Dweller during a Solstice, because that's when their powers go crazy, and then they have enough power to destroy a Dweller. And then it kind of evolves from there, where there are some betrayals, there are some twists and turns, and then it turns out that the world is a whole lot bigger than you once thought.
Mm-hmm.
The game consistently kept surprising me in ways that was satisfying, because, you know, there's the meme of subverting expectations, right? Doing something that the player doesn't expect on its own isn't really noteworthy, but doing a twist that actually
works,
enhances the story and, you know, recontextualizes the game or makes the story more interesting. That's kind of the point of doing a twist. And there were several points during this game where I was like, oh, I was legitimately not expecting that. Specifically the identity of one of your party members, where it's like, I thought she was wearing a mask because she was a ninja.
Yeah.
It turns out there's a really good reason that she's wearing a mask. And I was like, I did not see that coming.
The moment when you're in the Sea of Stars and you're just like zooming, I shot a load in my pants.
I don't know why, but you arrive at the future land. I guess it's not the future land. It's another dimension.
Yeah.
You arrive at this other dimension and suddenly your UI is different. The music is the same, but in a different like genre.
More
like you're fighting like robots.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really fucking cool. And that took me off guard quite a bit.
Yeah.
And that whole area, I really love. That is my vibe, definitely.
What's our opinion on Garl?
Best boy.
I love Garl.
He's your boy? Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
Okay. Go on.
I love Garl. He's great.
I was so fucking scared. Or not scared. I was worried they would do the thing that they did in Xenoblade 3, where, oh, your friend, he wasn't really your friend, he was the enemy the whole time! I didn't want them to do that.
Shania?
Huh?
No, I think he's talking about Yoren.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I didn't want them to do that, and they didn't do it. And they made him, like, really cool. And I was really sad when he died.
Yeah, Garl's just kind of a bro.
He's just a guy. Like,
he's a genuine dude. He loves what he does. He doesn't have the same power as his friends, but he doesn't give a fuck.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. He's just a very compelling, cute character.
And the reason I ask is because I did see on the Steam page, like the Steam user reviews, some people complaining that he was annoying. I didn't know what you guys thought, but evidently you loved him.
Yeah, he was great.
I'm somewhere in the middle. Like, I see both sides of it. He is a charming guy, and he's just really friendly, and that's, you know, it's hard to hate a character like that. But at the same time, there was a little bit of a, like, not really a Gary Stu type thing, but there were some moments where it's like, okay, this is a little fan service-y. When he fights the Dweller with them, despite the fact that, what was his name? Headmaster Moran?
Mm-hmm.
He was like, yeah, you probably shouldn't be here. You're just going to get yourself killed. But then him being there ends up saving the day because he blows open the roof so that they can get more power from the solstice and stuff like that. And then there's the whole thing with the sky giants where he's like, I'm going to bake a giant loaf of bread to tame the sky snake guy at the sleeper. And mm-hmm. And then they're like, what? You can't do that. And they're like, jibber jabber, jibber jabber. And he just somehow knows exactly what those people want. That felt a little fan service-y kind of.
Is that when he was making the bread?
Yes.
Yeah. Listen, I've never had a moment that was more, I guess, literally me than that moment. Because I like to make bread. And he made a big piece of bread in a volcano.
Did you make, like, beer bread when we were at the Philly?
Yeah, when we were in Philly, I made y'all some beer bread. It's my signature.
So I guess that's true, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what, Ryan? Sometimes when I was reading Garl, I read him as you sometimes.
Oh.
Not gonna lie.
Thanks.
Mostly because of the bread thing. When he started baking the bread, I'm like, oh, okay, this is like, I understand now.
He was literally me.
As much as I did love this game, I am picking it as game of the year because honestly, it's out of everything I played this year, it's the one I would most like to play again.
Mm-hmm.
That's just kind of the reason. It's like when I was into it, I was into it. Like I was focused and completely engrossed. But there are a couple things that I do want to point out that I didn't like. Like, the stuff with Garl is really a nitpick, in my opinion. Evidently, this game is a backdoor prequel to a game called The Messenger.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Which I never played. Apparently, there's, like, a demon character who looks like Brugaves. In the middle of the game, the focus of the story is on preventing this, the Dweller of Strife from resurrecting. He's basically a giant eyeball. Which is like, after all the build-up to this thing, it's like, oh, it killed 30 Solstice Warriors, including the former Headmaster, and now it's going to destroy the world if you don't do something, and you're almost powerless to stop it. And then you fight it, and it's just a giant eyeball with wings. And then you lose, and then Aphoril shows up and takes the Acolytes and the Dweller through a portal, and apparently turns them into the final boss of the Messenger? The Demon King or something?
Yeah, sort of. Yes.
But it's like, from the perspective of this game, and as someone who had never played The Messenger, I was just like, okay, the Dweller of Strife and the Acolytes combined into a single entity, that's going to be the final boss, right? It's going to come back later. And then it just doesn't. And it's like, what happened to that? Where did that plot thread go? It was such a focus of the middle of the game, and now it's just over. And then the second problem I have is, did you ever finish Final Fantasy V, King?
No.
How far did you get?
I got the little girl who replaces the old guy.
Okay, so you got Kryle.
Yeah.
And I think that's before you go to X-Death's Fortress, I think. But that game basically takes place in three chunks because there are three worlds you play in. Like, the big reveal of Final Fantasy V is X-Death's world, or Galoof's world, and Bartz's world are two halves of the same world that were split apart to prevent access to the void. And X-Death's mm-hmm. evil plan is to recombine the worlds together so he can go into the void and gain ultimate power, because he's basically evil personified. The point being that the scope of the game just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it kind of climaxes with like a big multi-dimensional world-ending catastrophe. And that seemed like the route that Sea of Stars was going to take, where it's like, okay, there's a Sea of Stars. There's potentially millions of different timelines because of the whole, all the shenanigans that Rashaan and Aforo had been up to for thousands of years. But then you only go to one other world, and then you fight Erlina, transformed into a demon, and then the game ends. And then, of course, there's the second ending, which I did get. And I'm not going to spoil it for Ryan, because she definitely needs to do that.
Does it end with Isaac getting a Smash invitation?
Yes.
I knew it.
Spoilers.
The true ending does some pretty cool shit. I think it's definitely worth doing.
Yeah, it's worth it, even though it's a lot of work, which I was fine with for the most part, because I had done most of those side quests already. Basically, for anyone who's not familiar, you kind of have to 100% the game in order to see the true ending. But the true ending is more satisfying than the base one. Because, like, what I would liken it to is if Final Fantasy V ended at X-Death's castle, and then nothing happened after that. It felt like it was going to go in a huge new direction. You were going to go to several other worlds. Then you basically just get Sarai's world, and that's just kind of it. And then you go to the castle, and then the game just kind of stops.
That's interesting, because I guess I thought that as soon as we saw the castle, I was like, okay, so that's the final boss, and then we're done.
Well, like, I knew that it was going to be the final dungeon, because the game flat out tells you that. It's like, this is the final dungeon, go do the side quests. Like, you get a little message. So I knew that. Up until that point, I thought I was only like halfway through it. You know, because like
I didn't get that impression really.
Because I had Final Fantasy V on the brain, because, you know, that's a game I really like. Then it turns out that, no, this is the final boss. And then at the end, Zael and Valair have to go back to their home planet. Their planet needs them. You know what I mean? It just felt like not a super satisfying conclusion.
I guess
conclusion.
The base ending I kind of felt weird about, but the true ending, I felt a sense of closure there.
Yes.
I felt like that was properly what was supposed to happen.
Yes, you get a more satisfying final boss.
The other thing is that I've played The Messenger, and I actually do think playing The Messenger makes a pretty big difference. And it is very interesting to me what they're trying to do here, which is to make, I mean, this is a prequel technically, but like a genre-spanning sequel series where, like, the next game they make is probably going to be in an entirely new genre, but it's going to either follow up these events or have it take place in the same world as these events, which is fascinating. And what I liken it to is the feelings that I got playing Sea of Stars after The Messenger are similar to the feelings that you get playing Xenoblade 2 and learning how it's connected to Xenoblade 1.
Okay, I see that, yeah.
And there's a really big catharsis to that. There are many areas in Sea of Stars that I'm not going to say rely entirely on connections to The Messenger, but are greatly enhanced by having played it before. Specifically, the island with the clock tower where you fight the Dweller of Strife, that entire island is where The Messenger takes place. Pretty much every area on that island is in The Messenger.
That's interesting.
And The Messenger,
and they remix all the music and stuff like that. So that was a really cool island to explore because of that. Now, I think it's fine on its own, but you obviously miss a big chunk of the appeal having not played The Messenger. Although, in the same way as Xenoblade 1 and 2, if you play The Messenger after Sea of Stars, you will probably get a similar feeling playing that game that you would have in Sea of Stars. Mm-hmm. The point of my thing here is that everybody should play both.
Okay.
Because I think knowledge of both will greatly enhance each other.
And The Messenger is kind of like a Castlevania game, right? Or Ninja Gaiden.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is it's a Ninja Gaiden-inspired platformer that sort of has a similar-ish twist moment, but it's more of a mechanical twist where it eventually becomes somewhat of a Metroidvania.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
Yeah, I was looking at it when y'all were talking about the endgame stuff just a moment ago.
But I really admire what they're doing here with the, like, each new game is going to be a new genre, but it's going to be in the same world. Mm-hmm. And not just the same world, but also the stories connect.
Yeah.
And they're going to keep connecting the stories, like, make, assumedly, whatever game they make next will probably follow up these two games in some way. And that's also why I thought that Rashaan and Aforal specifically were such fascinating characters to me, because I just love when you get Rashaan as a party member and you know, you start to figure out who he is. It's kind of wild to me that they let him be a party member. I don't know. It's like partnering up with fucking God. It's just very interesting. But yeah, I don't know. Thought it was very cool. I like the way that they've set up the world in Sea of Stars too, because in The Messenger, they don't really get into anything like that, like alternate timelines and dimensions and stuff. The stuff with Ephraul and Rashaan is mostly, like, you could say that they referenced them in The Messenger, but honestly, you would only ever know if you'd played Sea of Stars what the fuck they were even talking about mm-hmm. to begin with. So I like a lot of the stuff that Sea of Stars brought to the table in that regard.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's all cool and ambitious and all well and good. It's just, if I hadn't looked up on the internet, what I was just like, what does the Dweller of Strife ever come back? Did I miss like a side quest or something? And that's when I found out that it was a reference to The Messenger. Because, like, you know, you brought up Xenoblade, but it's like those games are called Xenoblade Chronicles 1, Xenoblade Chronicles 2, Xenoblade Chronicles 3. This is not called The Messenger 2. And I would have never guessed that this had anything to do with that. Too.
Like, I get what you're saying, but I think that's a little bit pedantic.
Well, what I'm saying is not necessarily they had to call it The Messenger 2, just that I would have never guessed it had anything to do with another game if I hadn't looked it up on the internet.
Yeah, that's fair. But also, I never really had the same thing with the Dweller of Strife, and I didn't even at first notice that it connected to The Messenger. I thought the Dweller of Strife was just like the, like in Xenoblade, how you think Eggle's going to be the final boss, but then he isn't. I just sort of assumed that was the whole Dweller of Strife deal, and then it ended up being that.
Yeah.
See, I guess I just never had these same hangups. I don't really know why, but I didn't.
Yeah.
Because Sea of Stars was originally going to be, it battles with my actual Game of the Year slot pretty fiercely. And actually, I think if you were to ask me on some other day if it was my Game of the Year, it probably would be. And I almost considered just making them both Game of the Year because I didn't want to be fucked to decide. But eventually I had to. And then Sea of Stars, I put it too. Mostly for one very, very, very small reason. And that it's technically the game that is the most inspired by other things and feels just a smidge less original than my actual Game of the Year.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause yeah,
which I don't even really care about. But when you're, you know,
if you have to break the tie, you got to get a little nitpicky, I guess.
Because at the end of the day, the fact that this is like Chrono Trigger, like Mario and Luigi, like all these things that I think are cool, and we don't get a lot of anymore on account of the fact that Alpha Dream went fucking bankrupt. I think that it is a really, really cool homage to those kinds of games without being stuck in those trends.
And also, for whatever it's worth, I think the success that this game had kind of shows that there is a market for these kind of games anyways.
Yeah.
If Nintendo definitely wants to take the hint. Like, not even just Golden Sun, but like, even if they do want to make like a new Mario and Luigi game, you know? I don't know what it would be like without Alpha Dream, but I'm sure, like...
See, that's interesting to me, and I'm not going to speak on Golden Sun because that's not really my ballpark, but... From my point of view, Sea of Stars, let me put it this way. As a fan of like Klonoa, if I got a game like Sea of Stars for Klonoa, then that would, for me, be kind of all that I would have ever wanted, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In the sense that I would rather have this than to revive Klonoa, which at this point I would rather it kind of just
not
stay as the piece of history that it is.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, having an entirely new game is always going to be preferable to me than bringing something back from the dead.
Yeah, and especially in the case of Mario and Luigi, I think that they had done pretty much everything with that franchise that they could have done.
Well, I guess that's kind of the thing then, where it's like when you know that like something hasn't, like if it died too early, so to speak. Like Lord knows, with like, you know, if I may, with Golden Sun, that's, I still think there's a lot that they could do. I mean, not even just letting, ignoring absolutely the fact that the third game ended on a cliffhanger, but like there's still a lot of like really cool like things with the world and the kind of lore. Like people were talking about like, oh, well, if they were to ever make like a new Golden Sun, should it be like a sequel to Dark Dawn, or should it be like a prequel to the entire series about how the lighthouses got made and we could see like alchemists in their prime and all this? Like there's stuff to explore. There's like untapped potential there. So it's like, it's cool to have a thing that reminds me of Golden Sun or that pays homage to Golden Sun. But at the end of the day, it never will be Golden Sun because Golden Sun is its own thing, you know? It's like you could replicate it, but it will never be like the real deal.
Yes.
Well, then if I may challenge you a little bit.
Sure.
What about bringing back Golden Sun? So is it specifically the lore in the world of Golden Sun?
That helps, yeah. But it's also...
Or is it the DNA of Golden Sun?
It's a little bit...
Because I would argue that a lot of games have carried that DNA into the future.
Yeah, and it's honestly, it's a little bit of both. It's also like, maybe this also sounds a little backwards considering, you know, the thing that the series is most infamous for is the excessive amount of dialogue. But also it's like there's a lot of charm, like that's very specific to Camelot's sense of humor, you know? It's like, again, you could have people kind of replicate that, but like it won't be the people who were writing the games originally, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I suppose the reason that I challenge you is that I guess I find it interesting because the implication of that to me is that so when I look at something like Klonoa, right,
mm-hmm.
I think there was a point at which I wish it would have come back. But these days, even disregarding the remaster we got, which I mean, honestly, the more that I think about it, the more I think there are a lot of problems with that thing.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, even disregarding that, whether or not that had ever come out, I always think to myself and I'm like, well, those games were like perfect to me. So I guess maybe the dividing line is that Golden Sun just never was good. Not that it wasn't good. That it was never incredible. You know what I mean? Because the impetus of it coming back is that it did not achieve what it should have achieved. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it would be fine to remain where it is.
Yeah. Well, I guess also, like, the thing is, too, with, like, one of the things that I always been clamoring is that, like, I always wanted, like a remake of Golden Sun, but, like, it is the first two games put together into one game because that's how it was originally meant to be. If we can look at, like, the Ocarina of Time Majora's Mask ROMs and, like, how there's now ways to, like, go into Majora's Mask through Ocarina of Time, you know what I'm talking? Like, have you guys seen that before?
I think yes. RZ has mentioned it to me, yeah.
Yeah, like that is a fucking crazy thing to do. And if I may, like, put out a call to action, if we can get something like that for Golden Sun in the Lost Age, then that would be it for me. That would be what I would want, because then that would be my favorite RPG ever made, because it's literally just like, it is picking up from where the first game left off, going off to where, like, it is that story told in one package, you know?
So well, it's that like, certainly seems understandable to me.
Yeah, that's more so where I'm coming from.
When you put it like that, I understand a lot more.
Yeah. So it's like, imagine having Sonic 3 and Knuckles, but not being able to play them back to back. That's regarding like one specific thing. But also, again, it's also just I always found the world of the Golden Sun games, you know, the world of Wayward, I always found it to be interesting. Like, there's a lot of interesting stuff there, and I would like to see more of it. You know, Sea of Stars doesn't take place in Wayward, and no other game really could, you know?
I guess I'd have to play Golden Sun to understand that,
mm-hmm.
because that I just don't think I could ever understand it.
Yeah, and it's going to vary from person to person. But, I mean, for whatever it's worth, I always found it interesting. And I want to see more.
Okay.
I will say, though, Sea of Stars definitely helped me calm down a bit. It definitely helped.
It scratched that itch.
It really did.
Sea of Stars, and the reason I ask you all those questions, because Sea of Stars is not even remotely the first time I've played a game that is like a lot of the stuff that I used to play.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe is dead and buried or whatever.
Yeah.
And through playing a lot of these games, and Sea of Stars feels kind of like the magnum opus of that, is like, do I ever need any of these dead and buried things to truly come back when the ideas that are still being inspiring people to make other games that maybe aren't the same or maybe don't give me quite the same feelings that I got, but are entirely different feelings? And then I can just kind of lay those things, not lay them to rest. That's kind of dramatic, but like let them exist as they were, appreciate them for their good and bad, and just kind of move on.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where I went with Klonoa, because I always wanted a Klonoa 3, because I just felt like, you know, you do the 1 and the 2, and why not do the 3?
Yeah.
But these days, I don't think that I ever need that. And it's not just because the remaster, because again, I actually, these days, I prefer to play the original games, if I'm honest, but I don't think that I ever could need Klonoa to like continue on. I'm sure if it did, I would play it, but mm-hmm. I feel much more content these days. I don't know. And I think it's just an interesting discussion to have because I don't know. When we get things like Sea of Stars, it's hard for me to continually look back when this is the thing we're getting now.
Yeah. I guess mm-hmm. I would just like to have both.
Porque well, no mean, las dos.
See?
If you're a dreamer, I guess, yeah.
Epic gaming win. Yeah, I don't know what else to say about this game. It was good. I really enjoyed it. Like I said, at the height of my engagement, I was just like, realized that 12 hours had passed.
Yeah.
So it's one of those games where, like, you're just in that flow state. You're losing sleep, but you don't feel tired.
Yeah.
So I loved it, even though I have some issues with it.
I also want to say that, like, me saying that, oh, it's not Mario & Luigi, it's not Golden Sun, that's not supposed to be derivative of Sea of Stars, if anyone was, like, drew that comparison. It's more just, like, it is nice to have something that understands what makes those kind of games work, you know?
Yes.
Like, I wasn't really looking at this to be, like, a replacement, because in my heart of hearts, nothing can replace it. You know, it is its own unique thing. But the fact that, like, it is here and it is acknowledging, I guess, its existence, and it's celebrating its existence with all these other highly regarded RPGs, it's validating, you know? And it feels good.
Yeah.
It's a very, very rewarding game, you know? And in a way, it feels like as if, I mean, like, a lot of the time that I spent on my channel was me yelling about how I want Golden Sun to come back. This, in a way, kind of, like, it made me feel heard in a way that I haven't felt before, so.
Yeah, and see, I think that part of it specifically is very valuable.
Yeah, yeah, I don't want to undermine that, though. Like, I don't want to, like, underplay that, because, like, that is a huge thing about this game.
Yeah.
Like, it's my game of the year for a reason. It's phenomenal.
All right. We only have one game left to discuss, I believe, and that's your game of the year, Mr. King.
Oh, I actually have one more game, but I'll go after King.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to step on your moment.
No, you're good, you're good. Sea of Stars is my game of the year, but there's one other game I want to talk about.
If you have one more game, you may as well talk about it now, because...
Sure! It's Star Wars Jedi Survive. The game was, like, really, really good, and I felt bad because 2019, I kind of slept on the Star Wars game that came out that year, Fallen Order. Because I thought Star Wars was dumb, but then I played it, and I'm like, yeah. Oh yeah, Star Wars can be good. Star Wars can be good if they try. And this game kind of, like, takes a lot of the things that worked in the first game and made it better. It's kind of like a Souls-like meets Metroidvania game. A lot of people say it's like Dark Souls and Metroid Prime put together. So Jedi Fallen Order is a very good game. Check that out. But, like, the sequel, I think a lot of people slept on. It got, like, no recognition during the Game Awards. And it made me sad because, like, it's pretty much a bigger, better version of the first game. It has, like, there's, like, actual side quests and there's side content. There's, like, bounty hunters you can find and you can collect their bounties and everything. There's, like, a really cool boss fight with Darth Vader. That's probably, like, one of the best boss fights I've played in a video game. The story's really interesting. It tackles, like, you actually see people struggle between the light and the dark side of the Force. And the main character gets tested and he kind of fails a lot. And that's really cool to see. So, and it's building up the thing for the third game. Yeah, don't really have too much to say about it.
Yep.
But it's really good.
Well, how would you contrast it with, the hell is that game called? Force Unleashed? That's like the only other 3D combat driven Star Wars game I'm familiar with. Besides like Battlefront 1 and 2 for the Xbox.
I God, it's been so long since I played The Force Unleashed, though. I played that shit on the Wii, man. Was the Wii version that much different from the HD versions? I don't remember. Like, I never played the HD versions.
I think it's like Sonic Unleashed, where they're technically two different games.
Ah, okay. So I might not have the best framework. From what I understand, I feel like as if The Force Unleashed is more level by level, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
And with these newer, the Jedi Survive, Jedi Fallen Order, they're more Metroidvania in the sense where it's like you learn new Force abilities and you use those Force abilities to unlock different parts of the environment. And then you learn more abilities there and then you unlock even more parts of the environment. And the combat is more akin to Dark Souls. It has the same mechanic where if you stop and rest at a certain spot, you regain all your health and all your stems or whatever. And also all the enemies respawn. And if you die, you lose all your shit. So it has that too, which... I honestly, that's one thing I don't really like about either of these games. That part always felt so pointless because, like, you literally just have to hit an enemy that killed you and you get your shit back. So, yeah, I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, like, the problem is that I think I played Dark Souls for, like, an hour, and I got to, what the hell is it called? The Undead Burg or something?
Yeah.
And I got to the boss, and I couldn't beat him, which was probably hilarious to King. I know it was funny for Eric, because he's used to speedrun Dark Souls. He loves it so much. And he's like, you couldn't beat the Tauros demon? What the fuck is wrong with you, dude? And I'm just like, I don't know, this game felt slow and clunky. I didn't really feel like playing it, so I decided to play something else. So that's about as much experience as I have with the Souls-like genre. So I don't really... I remember campfires. I know that you have Estus flasks. And yeah. That's just kind of all I remember. So it does help that it's like you basically have a campfire equivalent in the Star Wars game.
Yeah, and it's definitely not nearly as hard as the Dark Souls games. It's more so just... It is the mechanics. It is the kind of combat style, like the way how you fight your enemies. That is very Dark Souls. It's not really Dark Souls in terms of difficulty.
Okay.
Like, there are some optional bosses that you'll come across that, like, are pretty difficult, but, like... I mean, there's also, like, difficulty options, too. Like, you could choose, like, expert. You could choose the easy boo-boo mode. Either way, it's fine. And both games have really good stories to tell anyway. So, like, if you wanted to play on the easier mode just to play through the story, you absolutely could.
Okay.
No, these games are very good. Exo, I got you that for Christmas, by the way.
Yes, you got me the first one.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you should look at it.
All right. And you should play Chained Echoes, friend.
I will. I've been wanting to play that.
And meanwhile, King only had like three things on his wish list, and they were all so cheap that I had to buy them all just to get you guys an equivalent value between your gifts.
Oh, hey, I appreciate it.
Yeah, so that's...
But now I have nothing on my wish list, and it's all your fault.
That's a good problem to have, though.
Yeah.
Well, it just means that he has a longer backlog now.
Yeah.
We traded one villain for another.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's cap this sucker off with King's Game of the Year, and I think we all know what it is at this point by process of elimination.
Okay, what is it?
Hi-Fi Rush, right?
Yeah.
Really?
Yes.
Cool. I have not played this yet, but I do have it.
So as I said, I think Sea of Stars and Hi-Fi Rush may as well be equal enjoyment. It was really hard to pick one or the other, but I ended up going with Hi-Fi Rush specifically because it felt like something that I've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
In that it is an action rhythm game, which I'm sure exists somewhere out in the annals of the internet, but
there's
I've never seen
it. Some obscure PS2 game that nobody's ever heard of that probably does the same fucking thing, but nobody cares, internet.
I have never seen anything like this, and not only have I never seen anything like this, the way they pull the concept off is basically flawless. They pretty much lean into it in every single aspect, even, you know, because the whole thing is that it's a rhythm game, so obviously you're playing to the music, the beat of the music. So how it works is that every attack you do on the beat,
mm-hmm.
and it plays sort of like Devil May Cry, in that there are pause combos, but because it's a rhythm game, the smart thing is that your pause is that you just skip a beat, and then you do your pause combo on every other beat, which is extremely intuitive and makes it, honestly, pause combos just make more sense here because of that.
And they are literally called rests when you pause, which is a music reference.
Yes. And so another thing about it is that I think something that a lot of action game veterans said that I followed was that, and they all pretty much loved the game, but the biggest critique that they have is that the game doesn't really have, like, it technically has a higher difficulty, but it doesn't change any of the enemies that you fight. Like typical, like Devil May Cry in the harder modes will actually change the enemies that you fight and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like different enemies or the same enemies with new behaviors.
Yes. Whereas Hi-Fi Rush, the higher difficulty it has is basically just if you fall below a certain rhythm rank, then you'll just die. But the thing about it is that it's very difficult to fall below the threshold that they give you. So it kind of just feels like you're playing the game again. And the base game, if you're used to action games, is pretty simple.
Yeah.
Because the rhythm telegraphs when you're supposed to block and when you're supposed to parry, because nothing can hit you off beat. It is always on beat.
Yes.
And so, yes, you have to time it, but you are also being telegraphed specifically when you have to hit the button if you know what that beat is. So it can be a little bit simple, but I actually found it nice because I have never been particularly great at mastering action game combat.
Yes.
Maybe for some of the same reasons that you, Exo, say that you can't get into super complicated RPGs very well.
Yeah.
I think for me, I thrive in an environment where I'm able to sit down and examine something, and turn-based games are perfect for that because, you know, yeah, there's not definitely a lot of going on, you know, but in an action game, things are happening right then and there. And so it's easy for me to just default to my base moveset because I don't like trying to sit there and learn everything else is really hard in the moment. But in Hi-Fi Rush, it was really simple for me to do advanced combos because the rhythm-based approach means that I know exactly when I have to hit everything, and I can also get on top of parrying stuff much more easily because it's really easy to see what the beat is, even if you're not musically inclined, because everything in the world beats to the music.
Yes.
Visually, which is extremely smart. And it also does this in cutscenes, not that this has any gameplay bearing, but it's just a huge fucking flex, and I'm really surprised that they did it. And it makes even just watching the cutscenes extremely exciting because you'll get to they time the song so that a really cool part of the song is also when, you know, you arm yourself with your guitar thing, which is made of scraps of metal, and the scraps of metal will like hit your pipe in tune with the part of the music that you're at. And I think that the visual style is really cool. The way I describe it is that it looks like it was a licensed kids game made in the 2000s that never got released.
Mm-hmm.
It is very much in that style. I think the writing is also sort of in that style. It's a bit quippy, sort of, but I would say it's more lighthearted than straight up quippy because it does have serious moments and it is trying to get across a fairly serious message about artistry and who owns art in this day and age. And it's pretty explicitly against. I think that if I knew a little bit more about the music industry, I might understand what it's going for a little bit better with some of, I think it has some like musings on how AI selects what people listen to and stuff like that.
Oh yeah, I suppose you could interpret it that way. Like the Spotify algorithm.
Because the main goal of Roger Craig Smith is... he says at the end of the game that he wants to use the AI to influence people's purchasing decisions so that they don't have to decide what they get. Which to me kind of, I don't know, it kind of sounds like, you know, how people don't really go out and discover music anymore. They just kind of get it delivered to them by an algorithm. And so they never really go beyond what their tastes are. They just kind of settle into a comfortable groove.
Yeah. That's an interesting read.
I think that's probably what they were going for, but you can easily extend this to the games industry because, you know, in our lovely world, pretty much every business acts the exact same way with art.
Yeah.
So you can easily extend a lot of those concepts to the games industry and the problems that it has. And it feels in a year that was this shitty, it feels good to have the final boss to be a CEO that's trying to take credit for being a genius when he's actually a fucking idiot.
I mean, that's more or less how I read the, what the hell was it called? Spectra?
Yeah.
Was that Roger Craig's, or Kale
Vandelay. We just call him Roger Craig Smith for the whole thing.
Kale Vandelay looks imposing and intimidating and like super intelligent and on top of his shit. But in reality, he's not nearly as intelligent or capable as his mother or his sister and really just wants the power and the influence.
Yeah, without putting in any of the work. His last line is literally something like,
oh, I don't this even is so is much work.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he blows up.
That's great.
And then he turns into an AI ghost. Spoilers. Yeah, but it, like the way I read it was like, I don't feel like actually coming up with stuff that people want to buy, so I'm just going to control people's minds. And he doesn't seem to realize what a slippery slope that is. It's like he invented a super genius AI to control people just because he's lazy.
Yeah.
And the fact that he's voiced by Roger Craig Smith does actually make that funnier. Like, I think he fits that role really well.
He did a really good job with Vandelay. That final boss segment set to the perfect drug is one of the coolest moments of the year for me. That fight was exhilarating because of that. And that's kind of the strength of the game is that, and I guess it depends. If you don't like the music that's playing, then it's not going to apply, obviously. But I think all the boss fights, more or less, are really cool because of that they're set to the music. There's one that's set to Wolfgang's Fifth Symphony, and they completely play with that in the coolest possible way. I don't know. I just think it's a rad game. It feels like the most complete vision of anything that I've played this year, if that makes sense.
And honestly, yeah, it definitely came out of nowhere, too.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was... And I think I tweeted about this after I finished it, but I think the thing that I loved about it the most, and I'll talk about some other things I liked in a second, is that we were talking about Spider-Man last time and how it was like this bloated mess in terms of logistics and budget.
Yeah.
And like they're struggling to make their money back, even though the game sales wise is a success. And like you contrast this with Hi-Fi Rush, which didn't go through an extensive hype cycle with console war bullshit going on behind the scenes for months, like that fucking Starfield game.
Hmm. Yeah.
It's mid-budget. It's only $40 instead of $70.
It's an original IP.
Yeah, it's an original IP. It's only 10 hours long for the main campaign, and it feels satisfying and complete. It doesn't drag. There's still a post game to do. There's still customization and stuff to unlock. And apparently they added like a low poly N64 mode and like a tower mode or something.
Oh, shit.
In an update. So like they've kept supporting it. There's and apparently it's going to be moving to Xbox One, PS4 and Switch soon. They just revealed that this morning, I think.
I heard there was a rumor about it, but
it was just confirmed. There was like a rating in Australia or something. So it's basically official at this point.
That's fun.
Which is, it's cool that more people will get to play this awesome game, but at the same time, it does annoy me a little because this is like the one fucking Series X exclusive I could find this year. Like, literally, right after I bought my Series X, this thing.
Yeah, and I played it on PC, which is hilarious.
Yeah. It runs really well on Series X. It looks great and runs perfectly. So, you know, like, this game is basically antithetical because, like, you were talking about how you could read Spectra as a commentary on industry and how it tries to consolidate towards, like, a singularity of, like, a mono genre that, you know, and that's what Spider-Man 2 represents. That's what God of War Ragnarok represents. That type of
honestly,
game.
Yeah, honestly, kind of, yeah.
And this game is, like, the polar opposite of it in so many ways, where it is an original IP. It's not bloated and overly long and overly expensive, and it found an audience. It proves that you don't have to make mono-genre Last of Us, God of War, Spider-Man shit to make money and get praise, you know? And like,
yeah, and I think it's because of that specifically that it ended up being my game of the year. It's just that edge factor of it being in a year so shitty, full of bloated games with huge development budgets where a lot of the people that make it, their reward is getting laid off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or their personal information getting leaked by a hacker. You know,
no,
this feels like the perfect remedy to that. The perfect drug, if you will.
So the game is great. And in many ways, it feels like it was made specifically for me because there's one person on this earth who likes character action games, Nine Inch Nails and cute twinks. And that person is me. And I do have to say Chai is like top five husband material.
I love Chai. Now, see, this is the thing about the writing of this game is that there are a lot of games that I play where I feel like the quippy stuff feels like a crutch and it kind of annoys the hell out of me. But this game, I think, is just written really well because pretty much every joke they try to go for is really endearing and fun. And it just kind of fits the tone of the adventure in a cool way. And I think I like all the characters a lot. It's a big strength of the game as well, is that just all the characters are very enjoyable to watch. And I really love the friendship that they all develop. Because Chai kind of starts out like he doesn't really give a fuck. But then by the end, you really feel like he's part of the squad. You know, it's nice.
Yeah. And I love that they got Natsu from Fairy Tail to play a literal evil scientist. That was hilarious. Yeah,
who does a JoJo reference.
Yeah.
I love that, dude.
The only real nitpick I have, and this is going to be the nitpickiest of nitpicky things.
Sure.
Is that I found it tonally really weird that they murder people in this game.
It is kind of funny, yeah.
This feels like the kind of game where they get knocked out and have like stars spinning around their head and they lock them in a jail cell until the game is over. But no, they just straight up fucking kill people in this game. Like literally,
yeah, I think they get away with it tonally because they like explode. But yeah. They do pretty much just kill people.
Like, Kale Vandelay was a bad guy. Like, he literally mind-controlled his own mother just so he could steal her company.
Yeah.
But, like, he blows up, and then his mother doesn't give a shit. It's never brought up.
It is kind of funny.
So that was kind of strange. But, like, yeah, this game was really cool.
Sounds like it's a very Scott Pilgrim-esque.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
It sort of has a similar stylistic flair to Scott Pilgrim. Yeah.
And much like Scott Pilgrim, I think the main character is super hot.
Okay.
I have famously bad taste in men. Okay.
It's okay. I'm more of a Kim Pines man myself.
Mm. You know, that actress is in Star Trek Picard.
Listen, that's awesome. She's getting work. She was great.
So I guess that's Hi-Fi Rush. Really good game. And that wraps things up for 2023 Game of the Year shit.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
It just felt like the hits didn't stop.
Let me ask you guys a question. We're in the beginning of 2024. What do you guys want to do this year?
What do you mean? For this podcast?
Yeah. What are some things you guys want to do?
Well, this has nothing to do with fan fiction, so don't worry. But I had an idea that I think will be really fun.
Mm-hmm.
Hear me out on this.
Uh-huh.
Kingdom Hearts trivia.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Yeah. Yeah, that sounds pretty cool.
Like, King knows all of the, has read all the Ansem reports like 500 times, so he knows exactly what's going on. And then, like, you ask me, Michael, what was young Xehanort's plan in Dream Drop Distance? And I'll have to try to describe that in plain English.
I could do that. I could come up with devious questions.
And we also have, you guys wanted to do Monopoly for some reason.
Yes.
Oh my
yes.
God.
Yes.
Which we should definitely play Monopoly.
I know I said I haven't played it, but I was lying for the joke. I have actually played it before, but I don't think I've ever met a single person who has finished a game of Monopoly without getting bored and dropping it.
Yeah.
So that would be interesting. I still get next dibs on Let's Play stuff.
Yes.
And I would like to do either Yooka-Laylee or Glover, I think,
mm-hmm.
are the two choices. So I guess we'll figure that out. I've got plenty of wonderful fan fictions to share on the show for this coming year.
I know,
Ryan,
bullets.
You were really disappointed when we did the Tears of the Kingdom podcast that I hadn't brought any Sidon Times Link stuff.
I was?
Yes, you were talking about how his heart really lies with Link and he's just burying that for the safety of his kingdom. And there was, and so, like, knowing your disappointment, I went out and found some pretty spicy Link Time Sidon fanfiction.
I'm pretty sure, much like Story of Seasons, A Wonderful Life, that's just made up.
So you're saying you'd like to play the fanfiction game where you guess the fake one?
I mean, it's not that I want to.
But those are just some ideas I have.
I know one thing I want to do. I don't know how this would work, but like if we could play D&D, that shit would be really fun. Like actual D&D.
I think we should try it.
Oh, I think we should try it too.
Like actually try
it. Yeah, I'm with you. Like not even just talking about Baldur's Gate. I'm talking about like actual D&D. Make like actual characters. You know, King, we talked about this a while ago. Like, would you want to DM or?
No, I could certainly try.
You got some. Listen, we talked. You got some cool ideas.
Well, we'd probably need a guest then.
Yes.
Just to keep things interesting.
Yes.
And you'd probably need a guest for Kingdom Hearts trivia as well. just to be a judge or whatever.
I nominate Jebba Jebtube.
I was going to suggest him, actually. Yeah.
Yes. What about you, King? Anything you want to do this year?
I would like to survive till the end.
You know, same.
But I mean, I don't know. Those are cool ideas. I don't really have anything specifically.
Heard. Maybe this will be the year we do that fabled Xenoblade retrospective.
Got. Is there any need to anymore?
Maybe. I don't know. It's an idea. I'm throwing spaghetti at the wall.
Yeah, I'm already losing. It seems like Nominee has been messing with my head because I'm already losing my memories of the Xenoblade games. And I
do you know why she has the power to do that?
Because she is Kairi's nobody.
Yes, and why is that special?
Because Kairi is a princess of heart,
yes.
Which means that technically she shouldn't have a nobody, but so her nobody is an exception or something.
Yes, there you go.
I get 1 point for that rambly answer.
I did not know this.
Yeah, there you go.
Neat.
Ryan, I swear, if you get a higher score, or if I get a higher score than you is what I meant, like, that would be pretty embarrassing for you.
Why?
Why?
Like, me beating you in Kingdom Hearts trivia.
Beating him at the useless information game. Be just real saying. Embarrassing.
All right. Well, I guess we're running out of steam here and we're already done, so we'll see y'all for this next year, talking about video games. I don't know. What the hell's even coming out this year?
I don't know.
I feel
know,
like I ask this every year, but
But yeah, I don't know what's coming out this year. I think it's a filler year. Like, there's an expansion for 14.
Yes.
King, you got that 7 Remake Rebirth?
7 Rebirth.
Rebirth, yeah. You got that coming out.
Because I like cool games. You're right.
Notice how I didn't say anything. I just said, hey, you got this game that you're looking forward to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was the most this polite really way cool you could game. Have possibly put that. Yes.
Yeah. Hey, listen, I saw some stuff about
because
it.
Because I have good taste.
Yeah.
You have your own taste, yes.
Yeah, well... What is a me game, EXO? Can you describe that?
I would say Final Fantasy VII is a you game, yeah. The Final Fantasy VII.
Which one? The original? I've now played the original.
No. I mean just games like Final Fantasy VII Remake or whatever it was called.
Oh yeah, what does that mean?
It means that you like games that are JRPGs made by Square Enix with Bishis in it. And you like subversive plot elements that are controversial. Amongst a lot of people.
Okay.
That's just your thing.
Ryan, what is your definition?
Tetsuya Nomura, he's your guy.
He is. You know what? I accept that definition.
Yeah, listen.
Because he is a genius and he makes cool games.
He's got his own style, his own like way of doing things.
He certainly mastered the art of failing upwards.
He is having the most fun of any person creating games, I guarantee it.
You think he's having fun, or you think he's got to be stressed out of his mind?
Well, if he's been put on like 5 different projects, yeah, he's probably stressed out. But in terms of his ideas, he's having fun out of his fucking mind.
Look, I'll say this much. I am, at the very least, curious to see what they're going to do with the Versus 13 elements in Kingdom Hearts 4. I'm very interested to see like how that
I would love here? To see Kingdom Hearts 4, personally.
Yeah.
At all.
Is that coming out this year?
No.
Probably not, no.
I will eat a boot if it does, but no.
Well, that's going to have to be live and on camera.
Heard.
One of our podcasts.
Heard. I'll do it.
I'm going to hold you to that, my friend.
Yeah, I bet.
I guess we'll see, because like I didn't think 2023 was going to be a good year until it happened. So
see, I don't know, because, and I said this, you can go back. I looked at the release schedule of 2023. I'm like, guys, this looks pretty stacked. I don't know. Like, so
it's more like I made an effort this past year to play things that were more out of my comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
So like, yeah. So like coming in, I was like, eh, I don't care about Spider-Man. I don't care about Tears of the Kingdom, blah, blah, blah. And then I tried to go out of my way to try more RPGs. That's why I played Xenoblade, partially because your discussion of the third one kind of sold me on it. And, you know, I came out of this year with a broader horizon, you know.
Well, I'm glad I'm the reason that you played Xenoblade. There you go.
But with this year, I legitimately just don't know what's coming out. So
I mean, to be fair, I don't know either. I'm looking at this year and I'm like, okay, the first few months I'm going to be busy because they have Persona 3 Remake.
Oh, yeah.
Yakuza 8. And Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, all in a 2-month span, which is, may I say, fucking mean. Like, why are all three of these games, which are long as fuck RPGs, coming out in a 2-month span? That I put my middle finger up. That's mean. That's evil.
When is Persona coming out?
Persona 3 comes out in like a week or two, I think.
Really?
It's in January at some point.
Oh.
And then in February is Rebirth and Yakuza 8,
mm-hmm.
which Yakuza 8, Infinite Wealth, is supposed to be, they say, the biggest Yakuza game that they've ever made in terms of content, which is like, great. I get 3 fucking games that are going to destroy my life and sleep schedule.
I still haven't finished Persona 3 yet, so I guess this is my excuse. Might as well.
I need to catch up on 14. Like, that's what I want to do for me.
I thought Endwalker was supposed to be the last expansion.
Nah, it's the last expansion for that story.
It's the last game in the sense that Kingdom Hearts 3 is the last game.
Yeah.
It never was the last game, but people, I don't know, people hear the word last and then their immediate assumption is that it's ending.
Oh, it's the ending of a specific story. It's
the ending
story.
Of the story yeah. arc that they were building for not five expansions, technically 4 expansions, because Realm Reborn
so
is just the game.
Is there a mysterious black box in this game, too?
No.
Okay. That was 2023. That was our retrospective. We'll see you all for some more Unversecast goodness sometime this year. Before some more whatever.
Who knows what's going to happen? Maybe we'll all.
Ah! Please check out our YouTube channel for playthroughs of our favorite games and video versions of all our podcasts. This episode was edited by yours truly, ExoParadigm Gamer. Check out the links in the description to follow each of us on YouTube, Twitter, and more. Thank you all very much for watching our podcast, and we'll see you all next time.